Welcome to our listeners. This is Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review, your host today for the November 23, 2002 edition of The LaRouche Show, the weekly audio webcast that airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Internet at www.larouchepub.com. I'm going to ask you now to start sending your questions to the national spokesperson for Lyndon LaRouche's campaign, who will be our guest today, by email. Send your questions via the internet to radio@larouchepub.com. Or later on in the show, you can call our toll-free number at 1-866-857-4327. That toll-free number again is 1-866-857-4327. Back in October, before the election, Lyndon LaRouche was our guest on the show. Lyndon LaRouche, the Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate in 2004. He said at that time, "On November 5th, a change will occur in U.S. politics and international politics. We don't know what the change will be, but we do know there will be a very dramatic change. We have the worst financial collapse in the memory of any living person in the United States today. That is assured. This is the big issue." That's what LaRouche had to say. On the line today is our guest, Deborah Freeman, the national spokesman for the LaRouche campaign. Welcome, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Good to be here today.
Great. I'm going to get right into the substance and ask you to tell us about those changes and what the LaRouche campaign is doing both here in Washington and internationally to create a new leadership in this crisis.
Well, Michelle, as you know, prior to the November 5th election, Lynn had very clearly and precisely targeted Joe Lieberman and actually the alliance that had been born between Joe Lieberman and John McCain as something which was a pernicious element in U.S. politics that had to be wiped out. Within the Democratic Party itself, Lieberman was a disaster. He not only represented the legacy of the Democratic Party's defeat under Al Gore's presidential campaign in the year 2000 national campaign, but in fact it was Lieberman's Democratic Leadership Council which was pushing the party to run as a second Republican Party. And during the entirety of the electoral campaign, we were all faced with an absolutely remarkable situation, which was the United States in the throes of the worst economic collapse in our history and in the throes of the most dramatic crisis we've faced since the Revolution, with absolutely no issues on the table, no discussion whatsoever, and an electorate which was stunned into complete boredom and oblivion. Sure enough, November 5th came around, and precisely as LaRouche had directed, Lieberman was humiliated in probably one of the most astounding defeats in U.S. electoral history. It's traditional that during a midterm election, the sitting president loses seats, and George Bush is certainly not the most popular president we have had. But the fact of the matter is that although people did not have a positive alternative to vote for, they paid attention to what Mr. LaRouche said, they paid attention to the fact that Lieberman did not represent their interests, and to the degree that people showed any inclination to do anything in this election, it was to vote against Lieberman. Now, this is extremely important and has major implications for the period immediately ahead, because the fact of the matter is that we are in an absolutely dramatic breakdown collapse. We've never had a situation like this before. You have 46 out of 50 states inside the United States it literally declaring a state of fiscal emergency. And again, with absolutely no alternative in sight, except for what Mr. LaRouche has directly put on the table. You know, I've represented Lynn in Washington for a very long time, and there's very little that this Congress can do that would shock me. But I have to say, after November 5th, what the Congress said, and actually what I fully expected, is that we were going to then have a full lame duck session. And the reason why everyone expected that is because of the fact that we are in a severe financial and economic crisis. You have the vast majority, 46 of 50, as I said, states in complete fiscal emergency, and one would have presumed that the Congress would stick around. But in fact, once the issue of Homeland Security was taken care of, and once the question of the war against Iraq was finally successfully forced onto the back burner as a result of Mr. LaRouche's efforts internationally, these jokers recessed.
Right.
I could not believe it. They are out of session. So that here you have an absolutely astounding crisis, and there's nobody home. They just went home. Now, I mean, for people all over the United States, this has to engender a certain sense of panic. They left knowing that their inaction would take 2 million Americans who currently are receiving unemployment benefits, which is hardly enough to guarantee survival. But those 2 million Americans, by December 28th, are going to lose even those meager benefits. There is nothing on the table right now. And it is in the midst of that situation that Mr. LaRouche has once again, as he has repeatedly in the past, stepped into the void, has put a solution on the table. He has put together a proposal which is modeled on some of the initiatives that FDR took to bring an end to the Great Depression. Mr. LaRouche has called it a super Tennessee Valley Authority initiative. What it would essentially do is it would force a situation in which the federal government provided direct and guaranteed credit for large-scale infrastructure projects inside the United States, projects that are desperately needed, that would result in putting millions of Americans back to work, and which would create the tax revenues that the states and the federal governments right now desperately lack. But I will say this, although the program has a precedent in U.S. history, and in essence it's modeled on the same principles as Mr. LaRouche's proposal for a new Bretton Woods, for a new, more just global financial order. In order for us to enact Mr. LaRouche's proposal, and I will stress it's a good one and it's also the only one which is currently on the table, the fact is that we have so deteriorated our capability to respond as a nation with a combination of deregulation, crazy budget caps, this balanced budget mentality, that the package that would be necessary to actually guarantee that such an agency as the one LaRouche is calling for could function, and actually the principle behind the super TVA proposal itself requires a dramatic shift, probably the most dramatic shift in the political policy agenda in the United States that we've seen since the American Revolution. And the fact of the matter is that it is one which is long overdue, because the policy for the last 30 years has landed us into a complete pit. And, you know, the misery is going to increase. I don't even want to think about what winter in the United States will be like if we do not move rapidly to enact some of the proposals that LaRouche is calling for. And clearly he's the only one who's prepared to take a stand and to do what's necessary to see this come into fruition.
You hit the nail on the head. I was watching TV last night, and a little item came on about a notorious so-called Democrat, Donna Brazile, who I know you've talked about before. And Donna Brazile said, Karl Rove is a genius. So I don't know if they all ran home to join the Republican Party. It looks like a real battle. So let's take that first. So you had Donna Brazile saying Karl Rove's a genius. Joe Lieberman going to a big Mooney event. Actually, he sent his wife to get the award for the victims of communism, and who knows how much money he got from the Moonies. And then there's Lyndon LaRouche. How are we going to clean up this Democratic Party?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, for people who may not know who Donna Brazile is, Donna Brazile served for many years as the chief of staff for Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is the delegate who represents the District of Columbia in the United States Congress, and she's probably best known for the fact that she single-handedly sabotaged our efforts to stop the closure of Washington, D.C.'s only public hospital.
Oh, that's a hot issue this week.
It indeed is. And you know, Donna Brazile functioning during this period was just unbelievable. I mean, she operated literally as a lobbyist for genocide. But in reward for what she did, as Eleanor Holmes Norton's chief of staff, she went on to become the token black at the head of Al Gore's presidential campaign. What came out after that campaign went down in humiliating defeat was that Donna Brazile was, throughout the entire campaign, working very closely with John McCain's campaign staff, working with McCain to sabotage the campaigns of other Democrats, not only Mr. LaRouche, who had delegates stolen in a number of states, and you know, during the course of the Y2K election, Mr. LaRouche's delegates were stolen, but more significantly, thousands of voters were robbed of their right to vote, and that was something that we saw as very serious. But the fact of the matter is that this represents an enemy operation inside the Democratic Party. And when I say an enemy operation, I don't mean an enemy operation in that it's Republican, although in fact it is. But it's an enemy operation in that this entire Democratic Leadership Council crowd, Lieberman, Gore, you know, Donna Brazile is just one of their gophers. But what they represent is something which is directly opposed to the most vital interests of the United States. They are opposed to the principle of the general welfare, which is, you know, if you wanted to identify one of the building blocks, one of the foundations of everything that this country has established, it emanates from that commitment, the commitment to protect the general welfare of our current population and of generations in the future. But this grouping inside the Democratic Party, along with a very similar grouping inside the Republican Party, trace their own historic roots. In the same way that we can trace our roots back to the principles of the American Revolution, they can trace theirs back to the likes of H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell, to people who hated everything the United States represented, who hated the very idea of a nation state. And it is with that in mind that they function in this current period. And you know, in a period of great crisis, that's a very dangerous thing, because in a period of great crisis, what you depend upon is the durability of the institutions of the nation. And the United States is very fortunate. Our founding fathers were very wise in the way that those institutions were framed. But these people have a legacy of deployment against that. And, you know, the irony of it is that when you take a deeper look, and you do have to take a deep look, because one question which does come up is how is it that they managed to survive? They're certainly not surviving with the support of the population. And you know, we didn't have to look too closely to find out that what is behind this in terms of not only financing, but also in terms of ideology, is the Unification Church of Reverend Sun Yung Moon, otherwise what we know as the Moonies, right? Here you have what is without question the single biggest biggest source of corruption and perversion in the United States today. These people are pouring literally billions of dollars into both parties, and as significantly, they are not only buying off politicians, they are buying off religious leaders, former civil rights activists, constituency leaders. This is dirty money combined with sexual favors, and it is eating away at the very backbone of what people would expect to be the institutions that they could depend upon in a time of crisis. Mr. LaRouche has targeted this layer. We are going to expose it. We have to expose it, because the fact of the matter is that we will not be able, no question, we will not be able to implement the kind of policies that are necessary to rebuild this nation and to ensure the survival of our population as long as you have a cancer like that operating within the political apparatus in the United States. And I'm happy to say that one of the things that we are seeing, because the crisis is so deep and because there are no other alternatives around, what we are seeing is just below the level of U.S. Congress, among state legislators, among people who actually must answer to their constituents on a daily basis, we are seeing a renewed sense of seriousness and a renewed sense of openness to the kinds of proposals that LaRouche is putting on the table. And it's my expectation that probably before the new Congress is sworn in, we will have emergency hearings in probably no less than 25 states on the questions that are posed by LaRouche in this proposal that he's put on the table. And again, you know, we're talking about not only the provision of credit and credit guarantees for rebuilding the nation, but we are also talking about a very significant drive around re-regulation and bringing an end to this insanity that was born over the course of the last 30 years and this speculative bubble. I mean, the great irony, you know, is Americans traditionally, you know, are profiled and have this really obnoxious knee-jerk reaction against needy people, against people on welfare. They always think that people on welfare are stealing something from them. And it's that profile that's been manipulated very often to get people to go along with budget cuts and austerity measures and things like that, because they think that there's somebody out there who might be getting something for free. But I think the one thing that we have seen very clearly in this immediate interval is that the real welfare cheats in the United States today are those people who have been living off this speculative bubble for the last 30 years, because it is, in fact, that speculative bubble which is responsible for looting the U.S. economy and for leaving us in the condition that we are currently in. And I think that increasingly we are seeing a reaction against it, again, by people who do, in fact, have to answer to their constituents, and, you know, also very much as a result of an initiative that Mr. LaRouche launched this summer. In earnest, which I think is one of the most exciting and important initiatives since I've known Mr. LaRouche, and that is the drive to actually build a movement of young people in the United States. He has committed himself to organize literally an army of American youth who will fight for their own future, and I know that it's something that I've been very heavily involved in. And it's very gratifying, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, without something like this, we're handing these young people a garbage heap, and they really do deserve more. They deserve a future. They deserve the possibility of actually building a nation. And Mr. LaRouche is giving it to them. They're responding in very large numbers, and they're having a very significant effect on the political process, because they come in. They are fresh. They really don't, you know, they don't mince words. They're not interested in political correctness. They want a future. And they want a future not only for themselves, but for everybody who inhabits this planet. And they're emphatic about it, and they're emphatic about the fact that the only person who has been prepared to discuss that with them in an honest and honest and direct way has been Lyndon LaRouche. So they represent something of a mobile strike force, and they're having a tremendous effect. And I think that it is somewhere in that combination that that any sense of optimism for the future of our nation really does lie.
Debbie, I understand that we're going to have a couple of the youth movement leaders from the East Coast on the show talking about what they've been doing to shake up Congress. And I'm told that we have two people from the Seattle youth movement who are on one of the organizers' lines today and could get into a bit of dialogue with us. I'd like to put them on in a minute and give us a little background on some of the incredible events that were written up in the November 15th EIR, 12 days of breakthroughs in October and November, relating to the international youth movement that Lynn is creating. Seattle, France, Berlin, Pennsylvania, where you had the weekend cadre school, Monterey or Saltillo, Mexico. I mean, this is an incredible this is an incredible movement, and you just taught a class at the, one of those weekends, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and I have to say, I really enjoyed it, because what I did was I actually went through one of the questions that we have addressed with the young people, and it's something that they're very interested in, is the actual question of leadership and the world historic individual. And one of the things that I was able to do in a wonderful environment in the Pennsylvania Dutch country and the Amish country just outside of Pennsylvania state capital was to actually walk them through the 30-year history of Mr. LaRouche's interventions in the American political scene. And it was really wonderful because, you know, these young people, like everybody else, are hit constantly with disinformation about who LaRouche is and what he represents and where he comes from. And this was just a great opportunity to go through LaRouche's history and the history of LaRouche's interventions. And the one thing that emerges very clearly when you do that, going all the way back, you know, to his first call for a new world economic order and the absolutely historic intervention that the late Frederick Wills made. Those of us who knew Fred both as the finance minister of Guyana and as the justice minister of Guyana remember very well when he got up way back in the early 1970s at a meeting of the non-aligned movement that was taking place in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and put on the table Lyndon LaRouche's call for a new world economic order. That call, in essence, is not significantly different from Mr. LaRouche's current initiative for a new Bretton Woods, which is being endorsed by leaders all over the world, which is being discussed everywhere from the Italian Parliament to the Brazilian Senate. But what people were able to see was not only the unity of theme and the consistency of Mr. LaRouche's intervention, but what they were also able to see in a way which I thought was extremely important for them is they were able to actually assess for themselves, had those measures been enacted back then when Fred Wills put the LaRouche proposal on the table in Sri Lanka, they were able to see very clearly the misery and the destruction and the horror that could have been avoided had that been done then. And from their standpoint, that was sufficient to inspire them that they will not once again allow a moment or an opportunity to be lost. Because, you know, for these young people, I mean, if you step back and you think about it, for somebody who's 19, 20, 21, 22, what's happened during the course of their lives? what's happened which is positive? Well, not very much has happened which is positive, but what has happened otherwise has been the genocide in Rwanda, the ongoing genocide in Africa, the catastrophe that we saw in the Balkans, the ethnic cleansing, and now the Nazification of the United States, as millions of Americans are losing benefits, as hospitals are shutting down, as IMF austerity is being applied to our own population. That's the image that they have before their eyes. So when they see the potential, not only the potential to survive, but the potential for real human progress and for interventions that have real meaning, that can actually lift whole sections of the world out of misery, they're not going to let that pass by. So we had a very rich discussion of it, and I have to admit, I mean, I was delighted because I had the opportunity to do that in the morning, and my presentation was immediately followed by Lynn himself. I mean, it just was a coincidence. He was available at the time. He was here in the United States in the immediate area, and he spent the entire day with them, going through a discussion that covered everything from the need to re-regulate America's infrastructure, electricity, rail system and air travel, to questions of tuning and music. So it was a delightful opportunity, and I'll tell you, these young people came out of it with a sense of drive, commitment, and ferocity, which I haven't seen in a long time. And that was, of course, just a few days before the November 5th election. So unleashing them in the wake of that election has been very significant. And I'll tell you, I think the U.S. Congress will probably never be the same.
Oh, we have a lot of questions. That's right. Especially the ones who are influenced by the Moonies, I understand. They're being taken on. I don't know if all of our listeners know that on the Schiller Institute website, which you can access through the LaRouchePub.com, there is a fantastic videotape of the ICLC conference, the Schiller Institute conference from September, where a couple of dozen, I think, of the youth organizers came and spoke about their involvement in the movement. And this is an incredible video that people can access anytime you get on the internet. Don't do it till after the show, please. But it is there, and we will be talking to Maria, Delante, I think Rachel, and Wesley from the West Coast in the second half of the hour. So we're going to take a break for a minute. You're listening to The LaRouche Show for November 23rd, 2002. We have Deborah Freeman, the national spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche's campaign, with us today to answer questions and let us know what Lynn is doing and saying, which is a lot around the world. You can listen to The LaRouche Show every week and also an archive by going to the website www.larouchepub.com. That's LaRouche Pub, LaRouchePub.com. That website is your gateway to an incredible realm of culture, languages, and political activities such as no one else can bring to you in one place. For example, the international links bring you to Lyndon LaRouche's work in the Arabic language. We have a Russian website. You have the German language publication, Italian, Danish, Swedish. You link to the Schiller Institute, which I was mentioning, which has taken the forefront in the fight for classical culture. Learn more about the LaRouche movement by visiting the www.larouchepub.com, and also you can reach us by telephone, toll-free, 1-888 347-3258. Debbie, before we get into talking to the youth movement, how can people get involved, especially with this leafleting of this very, very powerful leaflet? Is your clergyman or congressman a Mooney sex cultist?
Well, let me just say that this leaflet is I cannot stress to our listeners enough how important this leaflet is. And you know, we make all kinds of jokes about this Mooney apparatus, and you know, we make jokes about whether or not you know, your member of Congress is hiding a young Korean bride in the ladies' room. Because of course, what Moon is famous for is his mass marriage ceremonies and his you know, and the fact that when you talk about a Mooney member, it has a very involved meaning. But if they want to show you their members, you should say no.
No, thanks.
But we are printing this leaflet in very large numbers, because all joking aside, this is a cancer inside the political process, not only in the United States. One of the things that is becoming increasingly clear, and we are putting this material together, people can get it from EIR and from EIW, but the Mooney involvement, for instance, in financing this right-wing religious fundamentalism that is threatening to erupt in just a complete Holocaust in the Middle East, the money behind the Temple Mount crazies, the money behind Ariel Sharon and Netanyahu, the direct intervention into the Israeli political process is being financially underwritten by this Mooney apparatus. Now we are getting these leaflets out. If people have any capability at all, we want you to take these leaflets to your local church or synagogue, to your local mosque, and really put it on the table. The leaflets are available. We can arrange to get them to you if you call in to any of the toll-free numbers. It is also available on the website of the LaRouche Movement. I would say that if you have the capability to reproduce them yourself, that would be very, very helpful to us. But you can get it at the website, LaRoucheIn2004.net. It's there. We want you to get them out. And what I would say is that in addition to mobilizing to distribute this leaflet, we do also have available in pamphlet form for mass distribution a synopsis of Mr. LaRouche's Super TVA proposal, as well as a more in-depth study of the question, which I really think that any responsible U.S. citizen and any organizer in the United States really does need to get their hands on. The EIR special report is available. It's available, as I understand it, from the EIR website. It's Mr. LaRouche's Emergency Infrastructure Program for the United States. And I would urge people to make sure that they have it themselves, but we also do want to get this into the hands of members of the U.S. Congress, and also, very, very importantly, into the state legislatures. I know that in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be addressing the National Black Caucus of State Legislators Annual Convention. There is a National Caucus of State Legislators Convention that is coming up. The month of December is an extremely busy month for setting the political agenda for the following year, and we really are counting on our supporters all over the country to get to work. But as I said, the leaflets are available. We have plenty of them available. We'd also encourage you to reproduce them yourself, but also get this background material, because you're going to need it if we're going to get this job done and get it done in short order. And I think we've got to look at the next 5 weeks as the absolute key.
I think you're right.
Young organizers are prepared to do it. They could use some backup from their older siblings and parents and stuff. I mean, we didn't leave these kids much, which was good. So this is a good opportunity to make up for it.
Right. Rachel, are you there on the line? Can you tell us something about the Cadre School in Seattle and what the West Coast is up to?
Yeah, our Cadre School was really good. We have people flying in from New Jersey, from Kansas, coming up from Portland, because they are inspired by the idea of a revolution, and they realize that, you know, this old guy LaRouche is talking about these ideas that nobody else in our society or in the world today is talking about. So it's actually really on the move right now. People more and more are realizing that we have to do something, that there's really no other solution. There's nobody in any politician anywhere that knows what to do in this crisis.
Now, did you run across us on campus or work or where?
I was just walking along the street in the university district one day, and I came across the table, and they said, "Hey, do you know that Osama bin Laden didn't do 9/11?
Whoa.
that idea inspired me, because, I mean, I've always known that I've been lied to. And they were talking about the Eurasian land bridge, which seems to me like the most logical idea for human progress. And I went to Cadre School a couple days after that, and these ideas of truth and beauty are really what life is supposed to be about, and I've always known that, and I've always known that it doesn't exist anywhere right now. Nobody talks about it in school or on television or anywhere. No politician talks about it. So this seemed to me like the perfect thing to do. Like there's no occupation other than this. There's nothing else like this around. And these are the ideals that I want to live my life by and make sure that other people can too.
Well, Debbie just said, I think, something we can't emphasize enough. The next 5 weeks is incredibly important. We could see the war break out. The chicken hawks have not given up. I mean, this striking thing, the audacity of the Congress to walk out and leave millions of people with no unemployment, no chance for jobs, no income. I mean, this makes Ebenezer Scrooge look like a great philanthropist. You know, people are going to lose their unemployment. Families are homeless and so forth. And there's nobody home at Congress. I mean, this is immoral. This is not what this country is about. So, Delonte, are you on the line? Because I heard that Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia crowd of the youth movement have been tearing through the halls or whatever in Congress.
Yes. Yes. Well, a group of us on the East Coast were all gathering together, and we come together to lobby Congress. Now, you can imagine 60 of us waltzing up in the congressional office demanding that they speak to us. So, you know, they do that. But it's one thing that you realize, I mean, quite frankly, most of these officers, they have a sense of fear, right? They have no moral commitment toward anything. And it's sad. And, you know, we talk to them. We do have a certain dialogue with the congressional office, mainly aides and everything. And it's what we get toward them is nothing in return. You have your two kind of people. Either they completely hate LaRouche and what he stands for, or they agree with him, but they won't stand up for the truth and the reason of what the human race needs. And, you know, to me, it is a sense of immorality. And if you don't, and if they're not addressing these issues, it's like, well, how much do you care? How much do you care about anything? You know, I mean, they're more worried about the positions, you know, what promotion they're going to get, what's the next house, right, my suit, rather than actually looking at what we're facing. I mean, we do address to them, look, if you don't go with these, what LaRouche is saying, the nation is dead. And that's the bottom line, you know, because you have nobody else talking about anything. Let's be honest, there's nobody else talking about anything. You know, you've seen what happened to the DLC, the Democrat Losership Council, or whatever you want to call it. What we did as LaRouche and the youth movement, we totally just smashed them, you know, with the complete, you know, getting literature out and leaflets out, there was non-members and members that helped us out. And you had old people that actually did that as well. And that there, the reason they lost, not only because we did that, but they didn't address anything that had to do with the benefit of the human population. They wanted to, you know, be swinging more to a conservative view, right-winging conservative view, rather than dealing with is reality. So what we do, I mean, we are having to go back into these offices and, you know, have to face and put toward a solution. No, it's only a solution. There's nothing else. I mean, you look, they have nothing else to lose.
Right.
There's nothing else out there. What are they going to lose, you know?
You know, I would say one thing about this, which, I really want to emphasize to the people who are listening. These guys adjourned. You know, they hightailed it out of Washington, I think partially to escape these lobbying brigades. They really don't like being called to task. But, I think that the most just thing to do in light of the current situation is to greet them when they go back into their districts, which was precisely the same kind of effort that they ran into in the halls of Congress with the LaRouche Youth Movement, which is that, you know, one way or another, I mean, they basically spend this period going off on junkets, but they do occasionally pop into their districts. And I think that young people back in the districts, as well as, you know, as well as others, should be confronting these guys and asking them, for one thing, what the hell they're doing there and not in Washington when we're facing this kind of a crisis. But I firmly believe, based on my experience in Washington, that one element of this early recess really was to escape from these very unusual and very demanding and confronting lobbying delegations that these young people have initiated. And I have to say, I mean, it certainly makes my job a lot easier. And I think they should really be applauded for taking the initiative, because I know, and I think it's clear from what Delonte said, it's not pleasant work. You know, these are not pleasant people. And it sometimes is very, you have to really, you know, maintain your sense of Christian brotherhood, not to take somebody's head off in the midst of some of these discussions, because they are just so oblivious to what is going on in the nation and in the world.
I got an email today from Nablus in the West Bank.
Wow.
And it's from an Israeli journalist who actually moved there, not to the settlements, but to the Palestinian side. And I want to read it and see if anybody, Wesley, Rachel, Delonte, Deborah, anybody wants to comment on it, because this is one of the people who has indicated how important Lyndon LaRouche's work is in the United States to him. So he wrote, this is part of a longer thing, "Bullets shriek in the air and hit an unseen wall. A machine gun replies, and soon a night orchestra of volleys and flares shakes the mountain air. The city is besieged for half a year since April. The walls on the square are bejeweled with bright colored portraits of the slain. A five-year-old boy or a young girl next to a mustachioed sturdy warrior. In Nablus, one is never alone. Eyes of the snipers and eyes of the martyrs follow one everywhere." We get emails like this from Africa. And I don't know how these people have heard of LaRouche, but I know that Lyndon LaRouche's campaign and our movement has an answer. So how are we getting across the international responsibility that we have to make LaRouche president? Anybody want to take that on?
Well, I think this is Wesley from Seattle.
Hi, Wesley.
Certainly what we're trying to do here is give people a real sense of what LaRouche has been writing about, and especially his recent writings on this question of immortality. What is it that actually makes you a human being? You know, what's life actually really all about? And questioning people and asking them if they actually taken the time to sit down and try to look at their own personal relationship between their own mind and the universe they live in. And, you know, naturally what LaRue says about this is that, you know, what makes you human is what you can contribute to, you know, not your family or your community or, you know, like with a lot of people we meet in this culture, you know, contribute to themselves and their own physical, emotional pleasures, but it's actually what you can contribute to the species as a whole. And you have to have that kind of a universal world view, that kind of universal conception of mankind, and you do have to, as a human being, you do have the responsibility to fight for people everywhere on this planet who are facing injustice, because it does affect every one of us, absolutely. So getting people to question that, you know, their own personal identity in that way is what I think is extremely effective on that issue.
Well, certainly this is a big deal in Congress. Deborah mentioned earlier that we succeeded through our movement and particularly through LaRouche's candidacy to put the war on the back burner, but that's not enough. Now we've got to shake up the hinterlands, and what can we do in these 5 weeks to address the super TVA?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously the question which is immediately on the table, and I do want to just say one thing about this question of the Iraq war, because Mr. LaRouche, back on the 11th of September, had identified a very clear perspective in terms of jamming up the works for a war that was supposed to have started before the November elections. And on several occasions, they tried to reinitiate the effort. I mean, indeed, that war was supposed to have preceded the week of 9/11. And instead, Mr. LaRouche forced Bush's hands. He forced the issue into the United Nations. And while it is undoubtedly the case that we forced that war onto the back burner, it is also still the case that as long as we have the depth of financial and economic breakdown, then the pack of fools that are associated with this utopian faction operating inside the Bush administration could still trigger a war. And if not them, then the events in Israel itself could be the equivalent of a detonator for a real nightmare. The only real way to guarantee that does not take place is to initiate the kind of reconstruction effort for the entire globe that Mr. LaRouche is proposing. But the United States has to be the initiator and the motor behind it, because we are the only superpower left. And the fact of the matter is that, pathetic as it is, our basic institutions, the structure of the United States, is still capable of the kind of internal reconstruction effort that can then emanate out. But what it's going to require is a couple of things. One is that just on the technical side, there is a package of legislation that is necessary. Not only legislation that would establish the financing mechanism for a super TVA, that in and of itself is relatively easy, because as I said, it is modeled on a historic principle that goes back to some of the things that FDR did. But what we also have to be able to do is we have to be able to undo 30 years of deregulation, 30 years of an absolutely destructive and psychotic commitment to free trade. It's whittled away the nation's ability to respond to a crisis, and it's going to have to be reversed. But the point is that for any of this to take place, for any of this quote-unquote legislation to be enacted, what you need is a sea change in the mentality of the American people. One of the things that, you know, I think we may not have time to do it, but I know one of the things that occurred just a couple of days ago was that a delegation from the LaRouche Youth Movement went to Maryland state legislature, to the state capitol in Annapolis, to testify at a hearing on the question of the state budget and infrastructure and Mr. LaRouche's emergency infrastructure program. And they were appalled, because what they saw was one constituent group after another getting up there in the most degraded way and humiliating way and begging for crumbs.
Mm, right.
And, you know, what they said is, God, why the heck would you do that? Why beg for, you know, a piece of a garbage heap when you can completely rebuild, when you can enact this kind of a, you know, this kind of a renaissance? But again, it takes a virtual revolution in thinking. I think we're at a point when we can do that. I think we're at a point where we can guarantee emergency hearings in many states. Why do I say that? Well, because you have 46 states in a condition of complete emergency with absolutely no alternative. How are these states going to provide services in the interval immediately ahead? They've run out of money. By insane pandering to popular opinion, they've enacted budget caps, so deficit caps, so they can't access emergency funds. They can't appeal to the federal government. There's nobody home. The Congress is in recess. What are they going to do? How do we keep our schools open? How do we keep our highways functioning? How do we provide the basic services that are necessary for day-to-day life in the United States? And I think that it is in that moment of crisis that the demand for these kinds of hearings, and you know, hearings on proposals like this are very easy. They are very easy to enact. The process of building the hearing and organizing for the hearing is itself something that raises the level of understanding and willingness to fight among people. You know, for a very long time, people would look at certain proposals that Mr. LaRouche would put forward, and they would say, well, gee, you know, it would be really nice if that would work, but I don't think it's going to work. You know, I don't know if it's going to work. You know, and you would get this nonsense. But the fact of the matter is that even if somebody today looks at one of Mr. LaRouche's proposals and says, well, it's nice, but I don't know if it'll work, it's true, you don't know. I mean, I know because I've studied it, and I know it will work, and I know that it has a foundation which is sound. But for somebody who's not prepared to do what I do, maybe you don't know. But what you do know is that there's nothing else on the table. What you do know is that if you don't do something, you're not going to make it. So people no longer have even the appearance of an excuse. And again, I mean, I think that it really does come down to what the quality of each and every one of us is, whether we're going to, you know, to grovel for crumbs that are not going to be given to us, whether we're going to continue to behave like lambs on their way to the slaughterhouse, or whether we're going to fight not only for the right to function as human beings. But, you know, one of the things that Wesley said is he referred to what Lynn has said about what it means to be human. One of the things that Lynn said at the cadre school that we had on the East Coast is he identified the fact that the one thing that distinguishes human beings from every other species is our ability to actually think two generations ahead. And he insisted that unless you actually are letting your own actions be dictated by what kind of a world they're going to leave for your grandchildren's children, then you're not actually functioning as a human being. And the amazing thing to me was that he was making that demand of people who are 19 and 20 years old. And to demand of a 20-year-old or a 21-year-old that he think in terms of his grandchildren's children, I think is a big demand, but I think that it's also a very joyful one. And I was excited to see people take that up. But I think that is the issue that's on the table with Mr. LaRouche's Super TVA proposal. But I would really, you know, insist in people's thinking about this. This is not a programmatic proposal. This is not a question of a nice little blueprint. What Mr. LaRouche is proposing is the establishment of credit and financing arrangements that would provide not one single penny to bail out the currently bankrupt financial institutions and would instead direct those monies toward rebuilding the nation. And he's proposing very serious regulatory measures to guarantee that. The financial establishment is not going to take that as a kindly proposal. As a matter of fact, for them, it's an existential question. So that what we are proposing, and people should be clear on it, we are proposing what is going to develop into one hell of a fight. This is hand-to-hand combat, the outcome of which is going to determine the future not only of the United States, but of the people who inhabit this planet for the next 150 to 200 years. And we're in a position to take it in a positive direction. So I would challenge our listeners to join us in that. And I would add that if we miss this opportunity, and it's a great opportunity. I'm happy to be living in this lifetime and to be associated with somebody like Mr. LaRouche because of the opportunities that it gives me. But you know, I would really say that if we don't succeed and if we don't rise to this occasion in this particular moment, history is not going to judge us kindly.
Is there any special number to call or way that people can join the youth movement and get in on this?
If people are on the East Coast, there is a toll-free number on the East Coast for the LaRouche Youth Movement. It is 1-800-545-5889. Wesley and Rachel, I know that there is a number out there on the West Coast. I don't know what it is off the top of my head.
I've got the Seattle number.
Why don't you give that out for people?
That is 1-800-325-8042.
Or you can certainly, call the toll-free number of the campaign itself, which is 1-800-929-7566. And we will, through that central number, put you in touch with a closest representative in your area. But we don't have much time. The next 5 weeks are critical, and it's really time for people to stand up and get moving. And I can guarantee you it's a lot of fun, and it sure as hell beats the alternative.